hello there and welcome. Today is Thursday, August 30th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, another member of the Trump administration will be departing. Emotional remembrances for Senator John McCain now underway.
John McCain and the Grand Canyon. Imagining Arizona without John McCain is like picturing an Arizona without the Grand Canyon. It's just not natural.
As tensions ramp up again, the U.S. reverses course on its plan to suspend war games on the Korean Peninsula. Also ahead, reviews of a Nazi hunter movie and a documentary about Hollywood secrets. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Donald Trump said Wednesday that White House counsel Don McGahn would soon be leaving his post as the probe into Russia's election interference closes in on the president's inner circle. Trump said via Twitter that McGahn will be leaving later this year.
Don McGahn's a really good guy. Been with me for a long time. Privately before this, he represented me. He's been here now. It'll be almost 2 years, and a lot of affection for Don.
According to media reports, McGahn has struggled to prevent the president from acting on his impulses to interfere in the Russia investigation. According to the New York Times, McGahn threatened to quit in June of 2017 rather than carry out Trump's directive to fire special counsel Robert Mueller, and later pushed back when Trump sought to oust Attorney General Jeff Sessions. The Times recently reported that McGahn has been interviewed at length as a cooperating witness by Mueller's team. Joining us now to discuss the significance of the impending departure is Robert Deitz, professor at George Mason University and former special counsel at the National Security Agency. So how big of a deal is this?
I think it's a big deal. The White House counsel, it's not a terribly well-known position. Most White House counsels operate in the background, as McGahn has done. But White House counsels are chosen by the president, and they are the president's most important source of immediate legal advice. Yes, of course, the president can always call the attorney general or the deputy, but they generally don't. They generally feel most comfortable talking to the White House counsel. My old friend and colleague, Bob Bauer, was the first general counsel for President Obama. And he saw President Obama all the time, and he was sort of the first contact for legal advice. So I think it is a very big deal. And what's so interesting is that the reports so far haven't gotten beyond the president saying he's leaving, you know, great guy, not he's leaving because of this. He's leaving because of a new job. We wish him well in his new position. They didn't say he's leaving because the job is so stressful and he's exhausted and wants to spend more time with his family. There was none of that normal Washington facade that is created around departures, and that's what I found most striking.
We have heard reports that President Trump was not happy with McGahn for apparently spending almost 30 hours over a nine-month period being interviewed by special counsel Robert Mueller with the Russia investigation. What do you think that would mean?
Not to argue with you, but the president has spoken out of both sides of his mouth on this. He claimed that McGahn spoke to Mueller with his, that is, the president's blessing. Initially. But now you're right. It sounds as though he may not be all that happy with it. And I suspect it's because the Times picked it up, wrote pretty lengthy articles about it. And Mr. Trump may have been surprised it was 30 hours in three sessions. That's a lot of hours. And particularly doing it 10 hours a pop, it suggests a pretty intensive level of inquiry. And that may have kind of done it for Mr. Trump.
Well, and it was only 11 days ago that we heard about the extent of that cooperation, that it became public.
Yes.
And apparently McGahn is also the person who single-handedly kept President Trump from firing the special counsel.
Yes, I've read that as well. I think this is a story that we're going to have to revisit when we get more facts, because I think this is a really big deal. You've noticed that Mr. Trump has a difficult time holding on to his lawyers, and I suspect in part, I mean, there have been reports on this, that he often ignores his lawyer's advice. He's quite undisciplined when it comes to using his, you know, doing tweets. And clients like that are very difficult to work with. And I suspect that's why Mr. Trump has had a hard time getting sort of frontline D.C. lawyers.
Do you think that the president is hoping to bring someone in who would not prevent him or refuse to fire Mueller?
As a lawyer, I always think lawyers are important, but Mr. McGahn certainly didn't prevent Mr. Trump from firing anybody. I suspect from the reports I've read, he was arguing that to do so was a mistake and laid out reasons why. Of course, there are lawyers who will do whatever a client wants. Generally speaking, they're lousy lawyers.
The White House counsel, what exactly is their role? Are they there to be an attorney for the president, for the White House, for the country? What exactly is their role?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. They do not represent the man who's the president. They represent the office of the president. They represent the presidency. And I'm not sure Mr. Trump ever kind of appreciated that distinction. The principal role is to make sure that the force of the executive branch, the power of the executive branch, is not diminished by, say, ill-advised legislation or, for example, trying to curb executive privilege. But certainly he does not represent the man who is or woman who is the president. It's very unclear what privileges exist. That is, if he's not representing Mr. Trump, does he have an attorney-client relationship with a man who is the president? I, for example, when I was general counsel at NSA, I could not claim that there was no lawyer-client privilege. If the president wanted, he would never have done this, but if the president wanted, he could instruct me or any other executive branch person not to talk about something on the grounds of executive privilege. But the attorney-client privilege per se does not exist.
All right, that's Robert Deitz, former special counsel of the National Security Council. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. casts doubt on the Islamic State's staying power. A VOA special report on Gabon's elephants that are vanishing. Women photojournalists in a male-dominant society are breaking the norm. And the U.S. is stepping up armed drone efforts in Niger. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, the White House on Wednesday said President Trump believes he has a good relationship with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, and there's no reason to be spending large amounts of money now on war games with South Korea. When asked about it by reporters, Trump blamed tensions with the North on trade problems with China.
As you know, China is the route to North Korea. 93% of the product and various things that go into North Korea go in through China. So I think that now that we're in somewhat, I don't like to call it a trade war, and I think, you know, our country is doing very well, but China's having a very, very tough time. And I think that China makes it much more difficult in terms of our relationship with North Korea.
The statement comes a day after U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis hinted that the military exercises could resume as a way to get North Korea to denuclearize.
We took the step to suspend several of the largest exercises as a good faith measure coming out of the Singapore summit. We have no plans at this time to suspend any more exercises.
Pyongyang is or has in the past denounced the drills as a provocation. Trump announced the suspension of those exercises following his meeting in Singapore with Kim, but lack of progress in ridding the North of its nuclear weapons prompted the administration to cancel a planned fourth trip to Pyongyang by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Robert Manning is a senior fellow and security expert at the Atlantic Council. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty military exercises are really the glue of an alliance. If you don't train together, he adds, you don't fight together.
We do two of those exercises a year, and I think what Secretary Mattis is implying is we need to keep our troops at the ready. At the same time, we've had reports, the IAEA report that verified that North Korea is still working on its nuclear weapons program, its missile program. They have yet to take the first baby step towards denuclearization, which is to give the International Atomic Energy Agency a full declaration of the inventory of its nuclear weapons and facilities. If we don't have that, we have nothing in regards to denuclearization. And so I think there's a lot of frustration inside the administration, including privately Mr. Trump. And I think this was a way of signaling to North Korea the party's over.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in is expected to hold his third summit with the North Korean leader, this time in Pyongyang next month. Is the South Korean president out on a limb by himself now?
To his credit, I think President Moon has tried to carefully link North-South reconciliation process with progress in denuclearization. But the North Koreans are very skillful at trying to drive a wedge between the U.S. and South Korea, and that they've been moving forward on a number of issues, most recently on the divided family visits, which is a big emotional issue. President Moon agreed to do another summit. They've been doing a lot of planning for how to reintegrate roads and rails between the two Koreas and all these things, which is fine if you're laying out a vision for the future, but don't forget, we still have UN sanctions in place, so they really can't do very much. What the South Koreans are doing is trying to take the North-South process as far as they can while being faithful to a link to denuclearization. But the problem is that the denuclearization piece is frozen. What's happened is we haven't really had a negotiating process. They had a summit. They made vague declarations about denuclearization and peace regimes with no idea what follows or how to follow it up with the hard business of detailed negotiations. Then when Pompeo on his third trip last time basically just told the North Koreans, we want to get rid of 60 to 70% of your weapons in 6 to 8 months, which is a very tall order. And there was no indication of what the trade-off was. It was, you do this, and then maybe we'll lift sanctions afterwards. That's not going to happen. I think what you have to have is a reciprocal proportionate process. If we want them to do a lot of denuclearization up front, then we need to sit down with the Koreans and the other actors in Northeast Asia and figure out what the appropriate level of benefits would be if they gave us all that.
Robert Manning, senior fellow and security expert at the Atlantic Council. Days of tributes to the late Senator John McCain began Wednesday with his body lying in state under a flag-draped coffin in the capital of his home state of Arizona in Phoenix. His widow, Cindy McCain, gently touched his casket and knelt silently to briefly rest her cheek against the U.S. flag before other family members and mourners walked past to pay their respects on what would have been McCain's 82nd birthday. McCain's sons were in their military uniforms, and daughter Megan McCain wept as the tribute unfolded. In a brief eulogy, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey described McCain as one of the few politicians who could get other lawmakers to set aside their differences in the interest of compromise.
John McCain and the Grand Canyon. Imagining Arizona without John McCain is like picturing an Arizona without the Grand Canyon. It's just not natural.
Arizona Senator Jeff Flake also spoke during the brief ceremony.
Let us remember thy humble servant with gladness and cheerfulness to answer his call to summon the better angels of our nature, to see and appreciate the humanity in our opponents, to more freely forgive so that we might be forgiven.
Later, the public began filing past the casket bearing the remains of the man who represented the state in Congress for more than three decades. McCain first drew the attention of Americans as a naval aviator who was shot down in a bombing run over Hanoi, Vietnam, at the height of the war and held by his North Vietnamese captors for 5.5 years as a prisoner of war. After a memorial service on Thursday, McCain's body will be flown to Washington, where he will lie in state Friday in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda after another ceremony. Then the final funeral service is on Saturday at Washington's National Cathedral, where speakers will include former Presidents Barack Obama and George W. Bush. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Childhood cancers are highly curable with long-term survival rates as much as 80%. But for pediatric cancer patients living in refugee camps, access to care is a daunting prospect. On Press Conference USA, we'll speak with two doctors from St. Jude Children's Research Hospital about their global efforts to continue care for displaced pediatric cancer patients. Listen to us Saturday and Sunday on Press Conference USA, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, the world remembers aviation pioneer Amelia Earhart, who vanished on an around-the-world flight in 1937. But there were other prominent American female pilots in the 20s and 30s who were groundbreakers as well, including Arkansas-born Louise Thaden and New Yorker Ruth Nichols. Author Keith O'Brien brings fresh attention to these women pilots in his new book, Fly Girls. It's now a New York Times bestseller. International Edition Sarah Williams talked to him and asked why the lesser-known women pilots are often overlooked.
You know, I think in the decades that have passed since this time and since Amelia's disappearance, we have reduced this story to just one woman, to Amelia Earhart. You know, she was the most famous of them all, certainly by 1937 when she disappeared. And her disappearance added mystery and legend to her fame. You know, in the years after she disappeared, there was, of course, much interest about what happened to her. And her husband, it should be noted, George Putnam, formerly of Putnam Publishing, he also did what he could to keep her name in the news. And I think the combination of her fame, the mystery around her disappearance, and Putnam's interest in keeping her famous even after she had gone, sucked all the oxygen out of the room and ultimately reduced this story of women in aviation to just one, when really that wasn't the case at all.
I didn't realize until reading your book that part of Earhart's first solo flight, her first transatlantic solo flight to Europe, was done by a man named Bernt Balchen, who was from Norway. He was, I guess, a consultant for her. He actually flew the plane. Earhart was with him. He flew the plane from New Jersey to Canada, to New Brunswick and Newfoundland. And then from Newfoundland, Earhart took over. But I was never even aware of that.
Yeah, we have erased that bit of the story, haven't we? You know, and that is significant. You know, she does fly solo from Newfoundland to Ireland, and so that is a solo Atlantic crossing. But Bernt Balchen was not just a male aviator. He was one of the most experienced flyers and ocean aviators in the world at that time. And he does fly her plane all the way to Newfoundland. And it's significant because Ruth Nichols, just 1 year earlier, tried to beat Earhart across the ocean, tried to make this solo flight, and she was going by herself. And Ruth Nichols does suffer a mishap in Canada on one of her refueling stops, which was not that uncommon at the time. And it's because of that mishap, because of happenstance and poor luck and a bit of poor planning, that Ruth Nichols doesn't get across the ocean first. And when Earhart makes her attempt 1 year later in 1932, Putnam, who of course has his hands in everything that Earhart does, wants to take no chances here. And so it's Bernt Balchen who's going to fly that plane up the coast all the way to Newfoundland.
Also, your book describes in detail the danger in flying. It's tremendously dangerous for both for men and for women. And then there's, of course, the horrible case of Florence Klingensmith, who was piloting a GB plane and was killed in an air race near Chicago.
It was incredibly dangerous at this time, especially air racing. Inevitably, pilots flying oftentimes single-propeller, open-cockpit machines would crash. I mean, they're flying at a high rate of speed, low to the ground, in competitive races. This was extremely dangerous. It was dangerous for the men. It was dangerous for the women. But there was a double standard. When a man crashed or died, as often happened in these races, he was hailed as a hero and often given grand tributes and memorials right there on the field with flybys and 21-gun salutes. And when a woman crashed or died in the races, as sadly would happen, she often didn't even get the most basic, decent human respect. Instead of being hailed as a hero, instead of being given grand tributes, the women who crashed and died were sometimes blamed for their own failures. and blamed in the press. It was really infuriating to read how they were treated during this time.
Of course, Amelia Earhart vanished. Louise Thaden eventually left flying. She was married and had young children. And later on, unfortunately, Ruth Nichols killed herself. But certainly, looking back on these women in so many ways, they were ahead of their times. They also, though, when you think about it, they really lived on the edge.
They were living on the edge. This was to be a woman in the late 1920s, not just flying planes, but racing planes, put you in a very small group of people. It made you a true radical, a real renegade. They absolutely were living on the edge, and they would all go missing, really, in their own way. Amelia, of course, disappears. Others disappear right before our eyes. That's not just something that happened. After the air racing time is over, after this decade ends, these experienced female aviators, they can't get a job doing the thing they love. They can't get hired at the airline. Some of them can't even get hired to be flight instructors. The sexism and discrimination remained. It made it hard for a lot of these women. You know, Ruth Nichols wasn't the only early female aviator who struggled after the spotlight turned away. A lot of them did because they couldn't get hired to do the thing they love.
All right, that's Keith O'Brien, author of the new book, Fly Girls. And turning now to the latest movies to open in U.S. theaters, we are joined by Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, let's start with Operation Finale. Tell us all about it.
This is the incredible true story. First of all, it stars Oscar Isaac and it stars Ben Kingsley. And Oscar Isaac is part of the Mossad, which is the Israeli secret service, you know, their special forces. And this is 15 years after World War I. You know, Mossad was hunting down all the Nazis, especially the high-ranking Nazis at the death camps and just anywhere within the regime of the Third Reich. They escaped. A lot of them did. Unlike Hitler and Goebbels and Goering and all those, you know, they committed suicide. But a lot of them scattered. And the most where they all went was South America because they don't have extradition laws there concerning the Nazis. So this is based on the true story that 15 years after World War II, that they got credible evidence that one of the worst offenders in the Third Reich, Adolf, who was one of the, no, is the guy who orchestrated the Final Solution. I mean, the details that he went into to exterminate the Jews. So they were eager to get a hold of him. Now, what they mostly did, Mossad did, is they would find these Nazis and put a bullet in them, and that would be that, and then tell the world. But the Israeli prime minister at the time says, no, we need to capture him. We need to bring him forward to the world and put him on trial. But that was, how difficult is that? You can't go into a sovereign country, kidnap somebody, and then get him out of the country. And that's exactly what they did. They went in, they observed him because he's got a different name, he's got a new family now, and he's sitting there working at the Mercedes-Benz factory in Argentina, and they followed his daily routine. They have to kidnap him, and once they kidnap him, put him in a safe house, how do you get him out of the country? So now they have to get impose his airline crew and pilots to get him out, and the tension is ridiculous because one thing happens after another, because at the time, Argentina was becoming a very fascist country. A lot of the ex-Nazis were there, and they were trying to take power there. So when he goes missing, they're searching the entire city of Buenos Aires. They're looking for him. So the movie is an incredible thriller about how this true story is getting one of the worst offenders of the 20th century on trial and getting him out of the country. And I'm telling you, it was really, really exciting. I'm not sure exactly how historically accurate it is because I've heard criticisms that some things in the movie didn't happen in real life, but overall it did. They got him out of the country. They put him on trial. Oscar Isaac delivers an incredible performance, especially when he's with Ben Kingsley, who plays Eichmann, and it's powerful. It really is. And you're going to hear a lot about this come award season too. So check out Operation Finale. It's an amazing history lesson, especially with the Holocaust. A lot of younger people today don't know anything about the Holocaust. We can't forget it. And this movie puts it right in your face.
It looks like you also saw an interesting documentary, Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood. That could be fun.
Oh, yeah. This is a tell-all documentary from Scotty Bowers, who complements his memoir called Full Service. He, after World War II, he was a World War II veteran, returned and moved to Hollywood. He was in the Corn Belt, like from Iowa. He was from the Midwest, but he wanted something bigger in life after World War II. So he descended upon Hollywood, worked at a gas station, this Richfield gas station on Hollywood Boulevard, and it's about him procuring A-list actors who were off-screen gay and lesbian. And we've heard all the stories, you know, all the rumors throughout the past 40 or 50 years about Hollywood. Of course, this is someone who specifically found men and women. I'm watching this documentary. I'm like, I can't believe it. Cary Grant and Randolph Scott were in a relationship. Hepburn and Tracy, that was a smokescreen, he says. And Lana Turner, Ava Gardner. He goes to everything. This man's like 95 now, and he's just spilling the beans on everything. He has the most incredible memory, and according to the director of the film, they verified a lot of things. A lot of the escorts, that are, he called them hustlers back then, some are still alive, verifying all of these things. So not only, they said like bachelors was a code word back then for being gay. It was a really scary time back then because, you know, the Vice Squad were always raiding these places and raiding gay bars, and also they clarified it as an illness back then. So this is just an incredible memoir for 95-year-old man, you know, telling all these things. Now, the thing is, you know, he does reflect on child abuse when he was younger. You can see in his houses that he has in Hollywood, he does a lot of hoarding. So I think that he's going through a lot of emotional things, not only losing his brother in World War II and all the stress with that, but also with the child abuse. So you really get into his past life, too. So, you know, they're not here to defend themselves. So when you watch this movie, you got to think to yourself what's real and what's not. And he says that age changed everything in the 80s, and Rock Hudson was the poster boy for that. I mean, he says that everyone in Hollywood knew who was gay and they just kept it quiet because the studios back then really took control of their image. But Hollywood Confidential, that magazine back then, was always looking to destroy people, their careers and their actors. So it's a fascinating documentary. I was blown away by a lot of the accusations made in the movie.
Jeffrey K. Howard, find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at VOAnews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The enduring defeat of ISIS remains a top priority for the United States. The U.S.-led global coalition to defeat ISIS is leading stabilization efforts that consolidate military gains, restore basic essential services, and enable Syrians to voluntarily and safely return to their homes in Raqqa and other former ISIS strongholds. Assistance includes explosive hazard and rubble removal, providing clean water, rehabilitating electricity networks, and other basic necessities. Since April, the United States has elicited approximately $300 million in contributions and pledges from coalition partners to support immediate stabilization and early recovery initiatives in areas liberated from ISIS in northeast Syria, including a generous contribution of $100 million by Saudi Arabia and $50 million by the United Arab Emirates. As a result of these generous contributions and other factors, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert announced the U.S. will redirect $230 million in stabilization funds for Syria, which have been under review. This decision does not represent any lessening of U.S. commitment to our strategic goals in Syria, stressed Ms. Nauert. President Donald Trump has made clear that the U.S. is prepared to remain in Syria until the enduring defeat of ISIS, and the U.S. remains focused on ensuring the withdrawal of Iranian forces and their proxies. We believe, said Ms. Nauert, that neither of these events will happen without irreversible progress toward a political resolution of the conflict, in accordance with U.N. Security Council Resolution 2254. This decision does not affect U.S. humanitarian assistance. The United States is the largest single humanitarian donor for the Syrian response, providing more than $8.6 billion in humanitarian assistance since the start of the crisis for those displaced inside Syria and the region. The U.S. will also continue to work with its international partners towards the achievement of a peaceful resolution of the Syrian conflict under a U.N.-led political process. The Syrian people deserve a country free of war, human rights abuses, and terrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.